Sean Patton is a longtime stand-up comedian who is going to be here in Austin headlining this weekend. That's November 24th and 25th at Creek and the Cave. Two shows each night, Friday and Saturday. Go to meseanpatton.com for more info and to snag those tickets. Sean, thank you so much for the time. How are you doing today?
I am alive and well and awake. I'm doing great, man. Thank you for having me. This is going to be fun.
People can't take the awake thing for granted with a stand-up comedian, even at 11 o'clock in the morning Central Time, because you guys work late. So if you're sleeping until 11 or noon, that's not unheard of, right?
Oh, I mean, it's not even, not only is it unheard of, it's pretty much just accepted. Because, like, even on a Tuesday night, especially when you live in, I live in New York, you know, you'll be sometimes, you know, going on stage at 1:15 a.m., you know, and, like, scheduled to go on stage, not just going on stage at 1:15 a.m. because the show ran late, but you're, like, scheduled to go on at 1:15 a.m. And that's, you know, pretty standard. So, yeah, like, even if you're not out drinking, you're still out.
There are a couple of stand-up meccas on this planet, and the Comedy Cellar is certainly in that category. What is it like to get to go to the Comedy Cellar on a regular basis and stand up and make an expectant crowd laugh like you're able to?
It's pretty wild. I mean, it's one of those definitely don't take it for granted situations, right? I think everybody takes everything for granted. That's just a given. But, like, it's so cool. Like, you go on stage, there's always audience. You know, people come from around the world to go to that place. So getting to do it is awesome. You know what I mean? And, like, pat yourself on the back, pinch yourself a little bit. It's also, you know, like professional sports, highly competitive. Even if you're trying not to be competitive, like, you're still, like, you know, everyone is going on stage giving their A game at any given moment. You know, someone like Chappelle or I am trying to give a bigger name than Dave Chappelle right now, but you know what I mean? Like, that level will just drop in and you got to go up after them. You know, that's like a, and there's no room for, like, sympathy or getting, like, oh man, do I really have to? You're just expected, like, yeah, you know, this person's going to go on stage and the crowd's going to go absolutely ape, just going to go nuts. And then you're going to go out after and try and have that same set. You know, it's crazy, but it's awesome. I love it. I love that. I think everybody does secretly. You love that, like, little tinge of pressure, but it's great, man. It's an awesome, it's awesome.
It's one of those things where iron sharpens iron, right? Where if you are around greatness, it forces you to come with your A game, because otherwise you're going to get lost in the wash.
True. 100% true. And, you know, you start to appreciate those Mormons. That's a moment, a Mormon moment. It's 90 seconds long because there's what? No electricity. No, you start to appreciate those moments more, especially the longer you're doing this, because you realize, like, you get through those good, there's really nothing else that can harm you. You know what I mean? Like, it's pretty awesome.
Maybe that's a good alternate name for us for soaking, which I'm trying to figure out whether that is an urban myth or an actual real thing in Mormon culture. You know,
I'd be willing to bet. I mean, I don't think it's just in Mormon culture. I think it's in, like, teenage culture, you know. I bet everyone's tried it at some point, not realizing they were doing it. You know, there's probably been rules like, hey, if you don't repeat, if you just do it once, it's okay. I mean, I was raised Catholic. We all have that guilty, you know. The moment I lost my virginity, I remember the next day being like, wow, so this is what it's going to be like going to hell, huh? Oh well, you know.
Yeah, sex was demonized in my household too. It was a non-denominational Christian household. We literally went to church like 5 times a week. I grew up in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And as soon as I was able to break free of those chains, it was relief, but it was also like, all right, well, this is it. I may as well enjoy this life now.
Right, right. Oh, so this is what it's like being a heathen. That's cool. I guess that's me now. But yeah, like, it's soaking. that's all I'm doing going forward. You know, that's it now. I'm considering me a soaker now.
Well, I was at a Texas Longhorn football game a few weeks ago. They were playing BYU. And so there were some of the, you know, there were BYU fans in the crowd, but there were also the button down short sleeve shirts, tie wearing Mormons that were there. So we called them over at one point, because I have a hard time believing that you and your partner get together, you make the connection, let's say, and then somebody comes into the room and shakes the bed or jumps on the bed. Like, it just seems far-fetched to me. It's like some of these sexual terms that we hear about over the years, the angry pirate and things like that, where it's a whole concept, but it's like, who in the world is actually executing this thing? And they were very embarrassed when I pulled them over to ask about it. I think they thought that I was maybe going to see if they would tell me about the gospel, and they got away pretty quickly. But I also wasn't completely convinced that soaking wasn't a thing, Sean.
I think their embarrassment tells me it's definitely a thing.
Exactly. Right?
Tells me it's like, how do they know? How do they know? Because if they're true Mormons, they're not online, right? They're not on social media. They don't know that all these sites are abuzz with the concept of, so they'd have no clue that anyone knew about it. So you calling them over to be like, is it real? They're like, how does he know? We've got to get back to HQ and shut this down. You know?
Well, speaking of heathenism, you were a part of Bert Kreischer's, I think you were on the Fully Loaded tour on land, but you were also a part of the Fully Loaded tour at sea, and it begets one of the great injury stories of all time. I don't want to celebrate serious injury, but you are dealing with a torn Achilles right now, and I don't know if there's a better way to tear your Achilles than how you did so. So how did you hurt your Achilles than the last couple of out at sea?
So I couldn't do the Fully Loaded on land. Man, he asked me to do it earlier this year, but I couldn't do it. I had another commitment. And it was, you know, but then he was like, well, you want to come on the boat later in the year? And I was like, yes. Cause I mean, if you've ever been on a cruise ship before, like, it can be crazy, but if you go under the right circumstances, it's awesome. And if you go with the right people, it's an awesome time. And going on a cruise with, you know, 15 other comedians who I love, who are awesome, and to be around comedy fans the whole time, it was pretty great. But every night, the night would kind of end with this massive karaoke jam, and it would go on for hours. And we were all encouraged to do it. You know, like, we weren't, you know, forced to do it, but they were just like, hey guys, if, you know, cause it'd be a bunch of people, just people on the ship are doing it. And some, you know how karaoke is, like, some people get up and you're like, wow, they really nailed that. And then some people get up there and they're like, wow. They really, whatever the opposite of nailing it is, they really pulled the nails out of that board. Good Christ.
It really soaked the bed.
Yeah. And it wasn't. Yeah, exactly. They're just soaking it with this audience, and this audience is wishing they would pump a little more. But and that wasn't just other people on the boat. It was some other comedians got up there and whiffed it, you know. But at one point, it was the last night of the cruise. And, you know, the energy, people had been partying and seeing comedy for, and that was the thing. They got on this cruise ship. They were there for it. 2,000 people. They were there for it. They went to, you know, all the shows were full. All the audiences were honed in, paying attentive. They'd been drinking all day. Some of them were waxed out of their minds and they were still like able to focus. It was impressive. It was so impressive that it's also proof that even if you're too drunk to watch comedy, you can do it. You can do it. I've seen it. I've seen people do it on a ship that was rocking in the middle of the freaking South Atlantic. So it's possible. So I don't want like any more of this. I'm wasted and can't. Shut up. You can do it. I've seen it. But anyway, it was the last night. It was probably 2 a.m. They only had a couple more people going on. And one of the producers of the karaoke thing was like, hey, go on, go do a song. And I was like, all right, but if I'm going to do it, I want to order off menu. I don't want to just, you know, pick one of these songs from the book, the karaoke book there. Like, can you find this song, Incubus, Anomaly, which it's Anomaly. That's the name of the song, but it's a pun. It's the name Anomaly. It's just a song that had been stuck in my head for 2 weeks. And I like it. I think Incubus is great. So they found it. I was like, let's do it. And I even got on stage and was like, some of you probably have no clue what this song is. And then the title comes on behind me and I'm like, half the audience loses it. It goes, it goes crazy. So I just committed. I just went full commitment level. I can't sing at all. My voice was also blown out from a week of shouting on stage and during events and drinking. But I committed, and I'm bouncing around, jumping. Oh, what's that? Kind of like that. Just going nuts, swinging my hair around, you know, one-man mosh pit on stage, just fully into the song. And I feel a pop. I feel... And I mean, you've heard athletes say this a lot. You know, you feel it. You can also hear it. That's the interesting part. And I know there's music blaring and you're shouting, but it's in your body. It's inside of you. So you also hear like a, huh. And I was like, okay, I'll deal with that in 92 seconds once the song's over. And then like, I hit the bridge of the song where it gets a little slow. The audience was with me. I'm like, let's do it. And then I finish off the song. And I even said it at the end of the set where I'm like, I'm pretty sure I just tore my calf because it felt like it was in my calf, right? And I limp off stage and, you know, the whole area where the comics are and like Norman's there and Burt's there and, you know, Giannis and Catherine Blair, they're all there. And I'm like, guys, I'm pretty sure I just tore my calf muscle. And I tried walking a little bit and my calf was just tensed up. And I was like, yeah, I'm pretty sure that's what just happened. And we all go up to Burt's like private area, which every cruise ship has one of these, by the way, like a super penthouse where only, you know, there's only one or two on the ship, but like you walk in and it's like a 3-bedroom, 2-bathroom apartment with a private deck and a private hot tub and a private viewing deck up a little set of circular stairs where you could be at the very top of the ship looking out for ice, you know, icebergs or whatever. not really. If there's icebergs in the South Atlantic, we went through a portal in the Bermuda Triangle, but no. And we're all up there hanging out, having cigars, having drinks. I'm like, yeah, I can't move. It's stiff. And then the next day when I got off the ship, it was like, yeah, it's still pretty stiff. I'm limping. And then I get to Minneapolis where I'm doing shows at this place, Acme Comedy Club, one of the best clubs out there. And I'm limping around for the next 4 days, like in pain, but trying to like, you know, mitigate that, trying not to walk, trying to keep it elevated and rested when I'm not on stage. And then I get back to New York and I get on a Zoom call with a doctor and basically just tell him everything that's going on. And he's like, can I see it? You know, there's no swelling. There's no bruising. And he's like, tell me in detail what happened. And I do. And he's like, okay, the fact that you were able to even consider continuing to sing a song and that you didn't drop to the ground in excruciating pain, that tells me you didn't rupture it. Because if you'd have ruptured the Achilles fully, the last thing on your mind would have been finishing a song. You'd have been screaming still, but not lyrics kind of thing. And he's like, you know, think of that Aaron Rodgers injury where he just kind of knew, you know, and just kind of like dropped right back to the turf because he knew like, yep, that's a bad one. I was able to like walk around and limp. So like he deduced like, yeah, it sounds like a partially torn Achilles surgery, but if you don't want to do surgery, you're just going to be limping around for another 6 weeks. Just don't re-injure it. And I'm like, yeah, I guess that's the rest of my year. So if you see me and I'm just limping around, don't be a jerk. Yeah. During karaoke, I commit. Okay. Yes. Most other athletes do it, winning a game or getting sacked or trying to shake off a defender. Not me. I was shaking off boredom, I guess, or Incubus. If you're out there, if you're listening to this, if you're a fan of this podcast, I did it for you guys.
you were doing it for underrated late 90s, early 2000s rock and roll is what you were doing it for.
Damn right.
You're choosing the non-surgical option then. You're just going to limp around for 6 months.
Yeah, I mean, or 6 weeks. Yeah, I mean, like, it's been 3 weeks since the injury, and it's already infinitely better. Like, I can actually, you know, I'm still limping, but I can actually move around. Whereas, like, you know, 2 weeks ago, I was home in New York, just leg elevated, icing, going between icing, heating. And, like, if I put any weight on it, it was just like, ouch. Now I can actually stand upright for hours and not think about it. I got a brace on it right now. But, yeah, I'm limping.
Are you going to be in a boot on stage at Creek in the Cave this weekend? Or
No.
Okay.
No, I'm passed up. I don't need to wear the walking boot anymore. And I also like, I don't need to wear it, especially on stage. I am pretty active and energetic on stage, and I can still do that without the boot. I'm not doing any track and field bits. You know what I mean? I won't get that animated on stage anymore, but you know. It's still, I just don't want the audience thinking about it. You know what I mean? Because if you're up there in a boot, people are just always going to be thinking about it. And you're going to always have to talk. Whatever you bring on stage with you, generally you have to discuss. And I'm like, I'm done. I don't want the audience to have to hear this story over and over again, you know?
Yeah, I think that's good. And you've also got an hour's worth of material that you've been working on for a while that you want to roll out to the people too.
Yeah, that is not injury-based. Well, not physical injury base, maybe emotional and mental injury base, but not, you know, I've pulled my mental Achilles a lot. So
thank goodness. If there wasn't some emotional injury that you were working through on stage, I might have given my tickets away, Sean.
Thank you. Yes, exactly. Guaranteed emotional injury discussion for sure.
So people who are watching the video right now, not just listening, can see that New Orleans Pelicans hat that you're wearing. You're also a big Saints fan, and that is because you are a New Orleans guy. Now, I spoke with Mark Norman a while back, and I was surprised to learn that he was a New Orleans guy, too. I know y'all were on the cruise ship together a few weeks ago. Yeah. Did y'all actually come up in comedy together in New Orleans before moving together or separately to New York?
No, I mean, I met Mark right before I moved to New York. Mark and I basically... Mark started after I did. I had moved to LA first for a year before I moved to New York. Because I thought I had to. Like back then, information wasn't as readily available as podcasts didn't exist yet, you know.
Yep.
So you just kind of for years had been hearing, like, you know, if you want to really do it, go to New York or go to LA, but you're probably gonna end up in LA. So at the time I was just like, you know what, I wanted to go to New York, but I was like, let's just skip the middleman and go straight to LA. So I went to LA first. I didn't hate it. I don't hate LA now. It's just, you know, after a year of being there, I learned from a bunch of LA comics and ex New York comics, like, oh, actually New York is a better place for stand up. And that's, you know, what I do. So I was like, huh. And I came back home for Christmas, and that's when I met Mark. He had started at some point that year while I was in LA. So I met him that year for Christmas, for Christmas break, and I hung out. I was in town for like a month because I hadn't been in town all year. So I just stayed around, you know, hung out, worked for my dad's catering company to make extra money. And Mark and I had started talking, and I was like, I don't know if I want to go back to LA. I think I want to go to New York. And he was like, you know, I'm going to go to New York. So I just started talking about, you know, moving to New York. And I moved in March of that year, and Mark moved, I think, in August of that year. So we knew each other by the time we both got there. But, you know, we had just met. We had just met, you know, a few months before. But we were buddies, you know, right away. I mean, especially when you move to a place like New York, especially back then, which, again, this was like 2007, you know, nobody had – social media didn't really exist yet. You know, the only social media that existed was Friendster. And MySpace was a newer thing back then. So, like, not everybody was even on MySpace. So, you know, having any kind of friend when you move to the biggest comedy scene in the world was beneficial. But, he's from, like, I always say this to New Yorkers so that they can understand. Mark's from, like, the East Village of New Orleans, and I'm from, like, the Staten Island of New Orleans. You know, if you're
right, because didn't he go to a predominantly black high school?
I mean, he went to De La Salle, which is like, you know, it's a very, you know, eclectic high school for sure. But but that's also New Orleans. Like, there are predominantly black high schools and predominantly white high schools for sure. But like New Orleans does, there are a lot of just like diverse areas. Like this area I'm in right now, I'm in what's called Bayou St. John, where like you can go three blocks in either direction and there's black families, there's white families. New Orleans does do the melting pot thing better than most cities in certain neighborhoods, and so other neighborhoods, not so much, but you know what I mean? Like, but yeah, Mark, he went to a good high school he went to a high school down the street from Newman, where both, you know, all the Mannings and Odell Beckham Jr. went, and probably some future professional athletes right now go, you know what I mean? So yeah,
you know, that's a good point about New Orleans. I went to New Orleans for like a six or seven year stretch, going to Mardi Gras every year, and one of the most fun times I had during that stretch was going to a casino near the Magnolia Projects to watch a Roy Jones Jr. fight when he went up to heavyweight to fight John Ruiz. And it was an absolute freaking blast, man. And you know, not being a complete jackass, you know, regardless of the situation, if you are enjoying yourself and being good to others, they're going to be good to you too in New Orleans.
Well, I say that about any city. Like, any city is dangerous if you're a dumbass. You know what I mean? If you are, and like, it's something you see here, something you definitely see in New York, but something you definitely see in New Orleans is what I call tourist privilege, which, when someone acts like because they are somewhere spending money that they're invincible, you know? So you'll see that here in New Orleans, people who are clearly tourists, and they're like, well, I'm going to New Orleans, and the whole city is my playground because I'm spending money here. So they're everywhere they go. They're drunk and they're loud. They want a second line everywhere, and they want to be out till 5 a.m. in your neighborhood, peeing in the street. And you see those people and you're like, ah, you probably should get mugged. You're being an asshole right now. You're in the wrong part of town doing the wrong stuff. So when people say it, New Orleans is this insanely dangerous city, I'm like, well, if you're a dummy, yeah, it is dangerous. If you're cool, if you're chill, if you respect the locals, if you show respect to the locals, if you, you know, keep the crazy drinking, partying, loony times to the crazy drinking, party, loony areas, it's awesome. But if you're wandering around someone's home neighborhood shouting about strip clubs, you know, and trying to take a piss on the side of their house, yeah, you might run into some trouble, you know?
You know, it's as simple as expressing those basic courtesies to one another. And that's something that I am harping on with stand-up comedy right now. Like, stand-up comedy is going through a real heyday, like a renaissance, if you will, where it's being embraced by a lot of people and a lot of new fans to the art form too, right? But with that comes the inexperience of knowing how to conduct yourself at a comedy club, Sean. And so I have my ideas for what some of the unwritten rules of comedy clubs are for people watching stand-ups. For instance, don't Mystery Science Theater somebody set. People paid for that person.
That's a great way to put it.
Clap when you're supposed to clap, laugh when you're supposed to laugh, and otherwise shut the F up. So for you, as somebody's on stage, what is something else, maybe another unwritten rule that that the crowd needs to abide by when they're watching comedy?
The one that I wish more people would abide by is open your mind up. Like, because what's going on in stand-up specifically right now is what I think happened to music like in the 90s. Whereas, you know, but prior to the 90s, you didn't have a bunch of indie bands and you didn't have a bunch of, you know, that indie bands are like bands that, like, you know, could tour without being household names, you know. And then all of a sudden the 90s, you know, it seemed like more independent labels started popping up, more types of music started popping up, more, you know, artists. And now you've got bands that can tour the world selling out 1,000-seaters in hundreds of different cities that you or I have never even heard of. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think that's, you know, everybody's got, bands have niche fame now. Yes, there are the Taylor Swifts of the world. Yeah, of course. But, you know, then there's also like the Regina Spectors of the world. So it's like, I think that's happening with comedy right now. And what that brings with it is a larger audience that maybe doesn't actually get what they're there to do. And some, you know, cause with all the clip culture, and I get it, man, like, you got to do what you got to do to get eyes on you so that you can, you know, sustain a career. I get it. But that does sort of encourage a very negative thing to me, which is audiences that show up expecting to become part of the show, right? And the problem with that audience member is their mind is shut, is a steel trap. They are waiting for you to acknowledge them. They're waiting for you to ask them where they're from, what they do, how long they've been together. They already have answers in their head. They already have these things that they think are hilarious that they're just going to wait to say to you so that they can become part of the clip. And in my opinion, yes, there are comedians out there who that's what they want, and they're very good at dealing with that and very good at making it funny. But then there are a lot of comedians like myself who I guarantee whatever I've written is more interesting than the interaction we're going to have. And that's not an insult. That's not a dig. It's just that I've spent hours upon hours upon hours doing it in front of many, many, many different people in many different countries in some situations. I guarantee it's going to be. And that's my one rule I wish more audiences would abide by. Because comedy is so popular right now, you get, like music, you get people who show up, they want to hear pop. They want to hear pop comedy. They want to hear that, not realizing, oh, maybe this is a little more indie style grunge sort of, you know, screamo, you know, different types of, this is more hip hop. This is more, you know, it's like, so I tell any audience member, like, do your research, because the days of just showing up and expecting a comedian to hit, no comedian is for everyone. No comedian should be for everyone. You know what I mean? Like, every comedian should be specific to who they are, what they find funny, their sense of humor. So do your research. It's not like 25 years ago in the 90s, I imagine I wasn't doing stand-up yet then, but like where you just showed up and the comedian was an unknown and you just kind of hope for the best. Now with the internet, you could do it right there while you're waiting in line, you know, just look the person up, watch a couple clips, see if you're into it. If you are into it, show up and open your mind up, be on their turf. I guarantee if you allow yourself to be on the comedian's rules and the comedian understands that and is giving you their 100% best effort, you will have an amazing time. And if they don't talk to you, they don't talk to you, you know, because I've heard that. I've heard this a disturbing amount of times. Get off stage, hanging out at the bar. Someone comes over and goes, oh, we really liked your show. Wish you would have talked to us more. Or, oh, man, really funny. I'm a fan of yours. But I was sitting right there. We made eye contact. You never talked to me. I was really hoping you would. And it's like, why? You know, why? What were you going to do? You were wearing a goofy hat. You wanted me to comment on the hat. Then what? You know, anyway, so I appreciate that you appreciate that. But also, yeah, treat it like you're watching a one person play until they engage with you. And I guarantee it's going to be more interesting. You're going to enjoy yourself more. You might even learn something.
That's the key. The stand-up needs to initiate with you. It's so interesting to think about what you just said, because a lot of comedians, in an effort not to burn material by posting it to Instagram or wherever else, end up posting a lot more crowd work clips, and that may work against them to somebody who doesn't know any better and wants to be part of that clip in the future. That is such a great point.
Well, also, like, and I mean, this is not a dig at anyone, because again, I don't like to talk shit about anybody who does this well. Like, it's like, you know, people have different styles. People go about this in different ways. Like, there are comedians out there who are very successful who maybe just aren't for me. You know, what they do, I'm just like, yeah, it's just not for me, but it's out there. It's clearly for some people because they're selling out, you know, clubs. Let them keep doing it. But then there are certain comedians who leaned into the crowd work because it was working. And now they've become like crowd work comedians. And to me, that's a bummer because I knew some of these comedians before they were full on crowd work comedians. And I thought they were brilliant. I thought they were awesome, brilliant comedians. Maybe they weren't getting the attention that they get now doing straight crowd work. However, I have a firm belief, and I know this will throw a lot of people off, but I do not think you give the audience what they want. I disagree with that idea. And there's a lot of people who don't, and a lot of people who are mega successful who don't, and that's them. I don't think you give the audience what they want. I think you got to give the audience what you want as the performer. I give the audience what I want. I will never give them what they want. The moment you start giving them what they want, they are now dictating your career. And that is a surefire path to becoming something maybe you don't want to become, versus I'm going to give you what I want. And what I want is to give you something great. And if I do that on my terms, I guarantee not only will I remain who I want to be as an artist, as a creator, but you will get what you really want as a fan, you know? So when I say I serve the fans, I'm serving them what I want to serve. Any great chef, musician, writer, actor has done this as well. You create on your terms and you give them something you think is awesome. If you give the audience what they want every time, you're going to end up serving them cheeseburgers over and over again, because people just want comfort. People just want simplicity, nothing complicated. They just want to be made to be comforted. No one wants to be challenged. But once you give them this thing that they maybe weren't thinking about and maybe weren't out there seeking to get, but once you give it to them and they experience and realize how much they like it and love it, that's the whole journey, if you ask me, is opening people up to something new. No one is going to openly say, I want to be opened up to something new, because that could be scary and weird and fail. But if you give it to them, aha, trust me, I guided you here. Now here we are. It's a success. So yeah, being in a comedy audience, in a showroom, with your mind wide open, I think that's the surefire way to experience what stand-up is really supposed to be, you know?
That was beautifully put. A poetic 10 minutes or so talking about the art of stand-up. Thank you for
sharing. Yeah, sorry. What a rant, yeah.
Something that has been slightly less poetic this year, Sean, has been your beloved New Orleans Saints. What do you make of the Dennis Allen era in Big Easy?
Oh, it hurts. It hurts my soul. Wait, you said you grew up in Dallas?
Yep.
So you're a Cowboys fan.
So weirdly enough, I'm an old school Houston Oilers fan. So now that they moved to Tennessee more than 20 years ago, I'm a bit of an NFL bastard. So I pick a different team every year. This year I'm a Lions fan. They're a fun team to watch, but unfortunately I don't have that team anymore in the professional ranks.
Oh yeah, man. I used to, well, it's, you know, what's super funny is, so, okay. A, I don't know. I only bring up the Cowboys cause I feel like Cowboys fans have been through this numerous times, but, and I feel like Patriots fans are going through it now too, where it's like post successful era. I mean, they're arguably, Patriots fans are going through it probably worse than everyone because they're going through post the probably the biggest dynasty in football era. And now they just stink. And like, you know, the Saints were never a dynasty during the Peyton era, but they were good. And the Breeze era, they were going to, you know, I think of this, what was it? Sean Payton was a coach for 15 seasons and one season under suspension. So Breeze was around for 16 seasons. I think 9 or 10 of those seasons were winning seasons.
Yep.
You know, and you could at least count on them to be efficient during that time. I mean, the Rob Ryan era, that was tough when he was the defensive coordinator. That was a tough time because New Orleans loved that dude as a person and he loved the city. He loved it out here, but his defensive schemes were, it hurt, man. I mean, I remember that press conference. I remember Peyton. I remember first reading about it on NFL.com being like, Sean Payton is not committed to return. You're like, oh no, oh no. And then he gave the press conference of like stepping down personal reasons, not gonna lie to y'all, I might coach again one day. And you knew it. It was like, oh, he's gonna go somewhere else, oh you prick. And then of course, what, one season later,
at least it's not the Cowboys though, or at least it's not a division foe.
Well, that's the funny part is, so in the, when I was a kid, the Saints were god awful. Until
that was the brown paper bag era for New Orleans when you were
I was a kid in the 80s and 90s. I mean, dude, you know what my first memory of the Saints is? Was the Ditka years. Oh, that was terrible.
Ricky Williams wearing the wedding dress with Ditka, dude, the cover of Sports Illustrated or ESPN, the magazine.
When they were selling the like Ricky Williams dreadlock, the braids, you could wear them. You had kids walking around wearing like the Dookie braids, man. It was, But I also remember being at a gas station with my uncle getting gas when everyone was like listening to the draft on the radio. And when there was like the New Orleans Saints select University of Texas running back Ricky Williams, just strangers at this gas station cheering and high-fiving because everyone bought into the hype that, yeah, let him trade away the next 2 years of draft picks. It doesn't matter. We just need one guy. You feel bad for Ricky Williams, but yeah, that happened. And then the Hazlitt era, which was better but it still, you know, was falling apart constantly. And then, you know, Sean Payton comes around, all of a sudden the Saints are a powerhouse in the South and the NFC South. And then the Super Bowl win. Good Lord, dude. Like my dad and my little brother were at the Super Bowl.
Oh, wow.
You know, my dad's a lifelong season ticket holder. So like,
Why were you not with them?
I was a broke comedian still living in New York, and I just couldn't afford to go down. And I refused. And also, they only had two tickets because it was like a lottery. But you know what's funny is that Super Bowl on a Sunday, February 7th, 2010. On February 5th, Friday, 2010, I did my first ever late night spot on Late Night with Jimmy Fallon, right?
Wow.
First ever, and you know, network TV spot. It went super well. And that was immediately it forgotten 2 days later when the Saints won the Super Bowl. So it was like by my family, by my friends, by everybody I knew down here. It was like, God, remember when I was on TV a week ago? They were like, oh, you mean when the Saints won our Super Bowl a week ago? And I was like, all right, you're right. That's more important. I get it. But yeah, man, the Dennis Allen era, man, it's hard because you like the guy. He's a great defensive mind, but like, you know, Derek Carr is clearly not the answer you wanted him to be, but he's not. I know Jameis is like I can't not see him in that Buccaneers uniform. And that you remember that era when Jameis was starting, when the Buccaneers had the stupidest looking uniform possible?
Yep. I think he joined the 30-30 club one of those years where he had 30 touchdowns and 30 interceptions in the same season.
And isn't he the only member of the 30-30 club?
Yes, he is.
You know what I mean? So it's like, so when he plays well, people immediately jump back on the Jameis train. But I'm like, no, he's not the guy. I wish him all the best, but I don't think he's the guy either. And like, I also understand how difficult it is finding a quarterback in the NFL, but like, it just feels like, man, Michael Thomas is hurt again. You're like, how that guy, I hate to say it, but I feel like it's time to let him walk, you know? Yeah,
that's a bummer because there were a couple of years where he was far and away the best wide receiver in the NFL, but injury issues caught up with him. He stayed healthier this year, but he just doesn't have that juice anymore.
And you feel like, are we wasting the best year of Alvin Kamara's career?
Yeah.
Because that guy's a Jedi. That guy's a straight up excellent, amazing. When he's that game during the pandemic where he wore the shoes that he got fined for, where he scored, what, 6 touchdowns in a game, and you're just like, God, man, he is everything you want in a running back, and it feels like they are just not using him and not applying his talent properly. Or maybe he's low-key injured. They just don't want to exacerbate it, you know? And the defense, I mean, I love Cam Jordan so much. That guy is an ambassador of cool. There is not a cooler defensive end out there. That guy is so awesome. And same thing with him. You feel like, oh, man, his last few years are just going to be this. It's hard, man, because I don't want to throw Dennis Allen under the bus. But you're like, yeah, I get some coaches are not meant to be the head coach.
It's that simple sometimes. Like Brandon Staley may very well be a good defensive coordinator. He has proven over 3 years now with the Chargers that he is a terrible head coach. I mean, it's great for me as somebody who likes laughing at somebody clearly getting over their head on the sidelines. But for Chargers fans, to your point about guys' primes being wasted, like how many Chargers fans are off their rockers right now because Justin Herbert, some of his best years are being completely squandered by a guy who to go for it on 4th and 3 versus kick a field goal every time.
Dude. And also like, well, this is so growing up when I was a kid, I forgot, there's a point I'm trying to make. I was a Denver Broncos fan as my surrogate team.
Oh, wow.
In the 90s, because the Saints sucked so bad that you were just like, I can't, by mid season, you're like, I can't do it anymore. Mm-hmm. I can't. So I started cheering for the Broncos for one reason. It's that my aunt and I never got along. She was a snitch, you know, just constantly ratting me out. I was always getting in trouble because of her. And she hated John Elway. And I started rooting for John Elway just to spite her. And in that, like those late 90s Super Bowl teams, I loved them. I love the Elway, Terrell Davis, you know, Ed McCaffrey, Shannon Sharp. Oh, yeah. That era was so awesome in Denver. And the second Super Bowl was against the Falcons, which are the Saints' arch nemesis, right? Yep. So that was a great Super Bowl. So I became this Denver Broncos fan. So when Sean Payton, surrogate team, and they remained my surrogate team on and off for years. So when Payton left us to go to the Broncos, I was like, you son of a bitch. Ah, they can't be my surrogate team anymore. Now, I mean, this would get me jumped if I said this out loud on the streets of New Orleans. But nowadays, my surrogate team is the 49ers.
Oh, what? No.
I know, dude. I know. And they used to beat the Saints to a pulp twice a season for decades back in the day when the Saints were in the NFC West. Remember?
Yes.
They were in the NFC West until the realignment. So the Joe Montana, Steve Young era, twice a season, they had feast that was the New Orleans Saints defense, you know? I like Kyle Shanahan a lot. I love Deebo Samuel, and yeah. I really love Brock Purdy. I love a guy who no one cared about, who's like, hey, I can actually do this better than all of you.
That is a fun roster top to bottom. Like, they've got so many good offensive weapons. Christian McCaffrey, George Kittle, who is a lot of fun to watch play. He's just one of those guys who loves the game, and they're – pretty sick defensively, too. Obviously, headlined by Bosa and now Chase Young, too.
I mean, that's crazy. And you got to love John Lynch. You got to love a guy who was like an excellent, what was he, free safety? Or, you know, excellent defensive player for years, won him some rings, probably in the Hall of Fame, that knows how to build a team. And it's being built from a player's perspective, not not a suit's perspective. So there's something you got to, I don't know, for me personally, I'm like, oh, as much as you want to hate the 49ers, especially growing up a fan of any team in the NFC, I'm still like, ah, man, but you know, in two or three more games, I'm not going to be able to watch the Saints anymore. Call me a fair weather fan. Fine. I just don't like being frustrated and heartbroken. Cool. But like, so I'll start rooting for the Niners again. Oh man, but God, it hurts. It's the, I really wanted Derek Carr to be the guy, man. But a good friend of mine, a comedian named James Mattern, who's from Vegas, who adopted the Raiders. When the trade happened, he texted me. That was, he's like, oh, good. Now you get to be frustrated with the guy for the foreseeable future. And you're like, oh, man. Oh, it hurts, brother. I don't know what's next because you don't see any light at the end of the tunnel with the Dennis Allen era. You know what I mean?
No, and you guys are right on the verge of making the playoffs too. You're in the worst division in football this year, so you could make the playoffs even if you were a game below 500 at the end of the season.
And also, as a fan, you also want to be like, but what's the point of going to the playoffs when you know you're not a good team, you know? And like just a little more heartbreak, you know? Like,
exactly.
Good. The biggest, I mean, dude, I'm sure every fan can feel that moment that you from years ago when that pass interference, that which was blatant and clear as day, did not get called, right? Was such a moment of pain. However, something I will point out to every fan who brings that up, because this hurts worse if you ask me, they did get the ball first in overtime. Like, yes, the Saints were robbed, clearly and viciously robbed on national television for not getting that call. However, they were then 100% given an opportunity to close the deal. The game went into overtime. Saints got the ball first in the Superdome. You know, sold out, 78,000 people going full on, full throttle crazy, and they couldn't close the deal. You know what I mean? It was like, oh, because that Super Bowl would have been amazing because it would have been against the Patriots. And if you remember, Sean Payton probably still does Bill Belichick's number. The Saints were really, I think the Saints were like something like 6-2 against the Tom Brady, Bill Belichick Patriots. The Saints were always able to beat the Patriots, and they would have faced the Patriots in the Super Bowl in Atlanta that year. And if you remember, maybe two Super Bowls before that was the one where the Falcons got humiliated by the Patriots. So it would have been the Saints playing the Patriots in Atlanta. So then every Atlanta Falcons fan would have been forced to cheer for the Saints because there's no way they could have cheered for the Falcons because the Falcons made them look like little babies. So it was like, oh, it would have been a beautiful, beautiful moment in the NFC South rivalry of Saints versus Falcons. Of like, hey, remember that time we came to y'all's house and beat up on the team that humiliated y'all? Yeah, you kind of still owe us for that one. But nope, it went the other way. And I think that was one of the most boring Super Bowls ever.
Yes, it was, as a matter of fact.
The Rams
won that game, and it was just a boring game. Like, I remember being on the air after the fact, being like, I know we're supposed to lot a Super Bowl that came down to the wire. That game was god-awful, though. It was terrible for the first three-plus quarters.
Yeah, and I think what was the final score? Something like 17 to 14. It was like a
13-7 or something. Yeah, it was a weirdly low score, too, especially in that era of football where teams were getting into the 30s.
And that was the Todd Gurley years of the Rams when they were explosive.
So he got hurt that year, if I'm remembering correctly. And then they had a fat running back in there. God, he was a lot of fun to watch. I can't remember what his name is off the top of my head. He's a guy who bounced around for a while, but he ended up finishing the season, though, if I'm remembering correctly.
Okay. Yeah, you're right, man. It was like a Super Bowl score from the 60s, you know? 13-7, you know, like back. It was like, did they move the goalpost back to the front of the end zones? Because were they playing with just the little one line, the old school face masks? You know, it was just like the one bar. But
watch the quarterback take the football and jump up in the air and throw it to the blocker down the field. That's called a forward pass.
That's what I say. That's just made legal in this year's NFL. The forward pass. It's all the rage. Yeah, man. But yeah, to answer your original question, man, I would love it if there was some crazy turnaround and Dennis Allen was the guy, because we want to root for that guy. His defense, you know, he was an awesome coordinator for defense. But I mean, what's the guy's name who was a head coach and was not good. And then he went to the Broncos and was their defensive coordinator and turned them into like the heyday of the what's the guy's name? 58 now plays for the he now plays for the Bills. Von Miller. Von Miller, like who that defensive coordinator, who I believe was the head coach in Dallas and was just not a good head coach, but then went to Denver and was like a Jedi level defensive coordinator during that era. I can't remember his name. Wade Phillips, maybe?
Oh yeah, Wade Phillips. Yep. Yeah. That's a good call. He was the defensive coordinator for their Super Bowl.
Right. But he was not a good head coach.
No.
But defensive coordinator, genius. So it's like maybe there's a future out there for Dennis Allen in that regard, but I just don't know. Yeah, I don't know if he's the guy for the head coaching job. Yeah.
So typically when somebody is from Louisiana or New Orleans and they're Saints fans, they're also LSU fans. But you were telling me before I hit record that you have a hard time rooting for LSU, which is merely the result of an extension of your disdain for Baton Rouge. What's up there?
I mean, dude, I don't know if it's just me because I don't think this is everybody who there's always going to be this weird rivalry between Baton Rouge and New Orleans. Right. Huh. And it's this weird thing because I think like Baton Rouge people, I've had this discussion so many times and it's so weird because Baton Rouge on paper is the same thing as Austin, Texas on paper, right? In the sense that it's the state capital, yep. Right? And there's a massive, massive, state school there. Mm-hmm. And I think UT is definitely bigger than LSU, but LSU is still 30,000 students. Yeah. You know, SEC powerhouse, you know, like, yeah, for sure. But for some reason, but Austin doesn't have a New Orleans an hour away. So like, in my personal opinion, you know, New Orleans is a beautiful, globally recognized cultural mecca of a city. And Baton Rouge just isn't. Baton Rouge is a state capital with a college, it's a college town. But something about Baton Rouge people, when it comes, for me personally, I feel like I've experienced this more than others. They just love to talk trash in this way where they put Baton Rouge on the same level as New Orleans. I'm like, I'm sorry, guys. You're just not. People are not traveling from around the world on vacation to come to New York. There's no books written about Baton Rouge. There's no songs written about Baton Rouge. And if there are, I've never heard them. I'm not saying Baton Rouge sucks, but Baton Rouge people just have this like crazy chip on their shoulder that they're like, well, we're also a city. It's like, yes, you are. Yes, you are, Baton Rouge. I know. Oh, wait, your bars close at 2 a.m. and you don't serve booze on Sundays because the Lord. Wow, that's a real big city move right there, you know? And so, like, it's not that I got nothing against the LSU Tigers when they are winning. Like, when the Joe Burrow year, when they won, that was awesome. You know, I was like, oh, man, this guy, I'm so happy to see that he's actually legit. But, like, you know, I'll back LSU, but I don't actively follow their season. I thought it was awesome, the female basketball player, the women's basketball last year when they won the championship. Yeah. That was super badass to see. And I was actually in New Orleans at the time, and every bar was playing that game, and it was fun, so fun to watch. Awesome, great. But, yeah, I'm like – and when it comes to football, I'll still root for Tulane when it comes to college football, even though Tulane's not ever going to be the same program LSU is.
They're ranked this year. They're actually decent this year.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. There's the extent of my college football fandom. You know, I didn't even realize. The green wave is right. That's shocking to me. Good for them. Hell yeah.
It's that rare year. All right, last thing now, Sean. I appreciate the extended time
of
today.
Course,
I'm excited to learn through your manager that FX just greenlit something that you're not just in, but you're starring in. What's going on there?
Oh, yeah, man. Thanks. It's a show created by a dude, a guy named Brian Jordan Alvarez. He's a brilliantly hilarious comedic actor. He's been in quite a few movies and on TV shows. It's kind of been like, his people have been waiting for him to have a star vehicle for a while, and this is his star vehicle. But he created the show. It's called The English Teacher. It's about, you know, so it's set in Austin. We're not filming in Austin, but it's set there. Mm. And it's basically follows his journey as like an openly gay school teacher in basically a progressive city dealing with how woke is the wrong word, but dealing with the politics of that, like, overtly PC world where it's like, but wait, I'm an openly gay teacher, but he's still got to deal with PC crap, you know? And I play his best friend, who's the reformed bigoted gym coach, basically, who's like trying to be a better guy and is a good person, but just constantly slips up, constantly makes mistakes.
I was about to say, so you get to say some of those fun lines that are going to get theoretically get a person canceled in 2023.
Pretty much. But they're all written by Brian, and the writing staff is amazingly hilarious. Like, some great comedians in there. Emmy Blotnick, who's a comedian I've been a fan of and a friend of for a while, she's on the writing staff. There's a bunch of other great writers on there. Langston Kerman, who is an amazingly hilarious comedian, he's also in the show. I'm really like, I'm so excited about it. I've got to find a way to like keep myself chill about it. You know what I mean? Cause you don't want to let your expectations get too high, but you also want to celebrate and want to be like, yes. But then it also, there's work to be done. Cause now, you know, we got to go film it. We got to do it right. And acting is not easy. It's a delicate, but it's awesome. I love acting as well. So like, I'm looking forward to doing it big time. I think we don't know anything about the production yet or when it's going to start quite yet, but we filmed the pilot in Atlanta. So I'm thinking the whole production is going to be in Atlanta, which means I got to move to Atlanta. Now, I adore Atlanta as a city. I think Atlanta is a fantastically dope ass, great, amazing city, but the Falcons can suck it. So I'm going to be walking around Atlanta with a Saints, with a Pelicans hat, with a Saints hat, with a fleur-de-lis shirt. But also, I've been to Atlanta enough as a Saints fan, and I think Falcons fans have been in New Orleans enough to know the rivalry is friendly. It's very friendly.
Yeah.
It's not like the Cowboys and the, you know, Eagles, where they're actively, like, you know, launching projectiles at each other's heads, trying to cause physical injury. Saints fans and Falcons fans, we'll talk smack, but we'll also hang out. Like, you know, we met, you said this before, we met when you came and saw me open for David Cross.
Yep.
In Austin. David Cross, diehard Atlanta Falcons fan.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of car rides where him and I were just going at each other. You know what I mean? Like, but in a friendly, you know, fun way. So I'm looking forward to it, man. I'm really excited about it and really looking forward to it. And, you know, I don't know exactly when it'll come out. I'm hoping by the end of next year, but yeah, it's going to be a great show. It's one of those shows where just reading the pilot episode, you're like, oh man, this is going to be a good one. And FX doesn't mess around when it comes to that sort of thing. They're not known for just putting up shows that suck just to see if they'll stick. They take their time and they do it right. So getting picked up by them it's amazing. It's awesome.
Some of my favorite shows are on FX these days and really in the past like 10 years now. They do a great job with that. What's the show called again?
The English Teacher.
The English Teacher. Okay. I imagine when you and Cross are trash talking about Saints and Falcons, you have the ultimate trump card. Most recent Super Bowl, and your team didn't suffer the worst collapse in Super Bowl history in losing one. Yeah,
dude, I mean, the amount of times I've been to Saints games since, because I would still go. My family has, you know, my sister has tickets, my dad has season tickets, my little brother. The amount of games that I've been to where the Saints are not playing the Falcons, they're just playing a team in the dome. And there'll be a moment where everyone just kind of goes, oh, guys, remember the time the Falcons lost? They were down. They blew a 28-point lead. Remember 28-3? Remember that, anyone? When they were up 28-3 and lost? Anyway, just saying. There's no Falcons in the building right now. We're playing the Colts or whatever. But let's just all take a moment to remember that time they blew the biggest lead in Super Bowl history. And, dude, I remember, you know, it was super funny. I remember watching that game in New York at my buddy's house, who's also a Saints fan. And we had like, we were rooting for the Falcons. It was one of those things where you're like, they're our rival, but if they win a Super Bowl and we've won a Super Bowl, it just makes the division stronger. Yeah. And it makes the NFC South, you know, we can now talk trash as a division. So, and also, you know, you're like, you know, Tom Brady's got four rings, you know, it's like rooting for Walmart at that point. But I remember, man, and you know, halftime, you're like, all right, well, they're going to win one. Good for them. And then by the fourth quarter, we're just like, oh, we're getting something so much more entertaining now. Oh, Dan Quinn, look what you've done. But yeah, it was, Yeah, but yes, to your point, dude. Yeah, nonstop trash. But I'll say this: I didn't grow up with a baseball team. I didn't grow up a baseball fan. David took me this year to my first ever baseball game, in Chicago. So I got to go. My first ever baseball game was at Wrigley Field,
Wow.
and we were sitting behind the batter's box.
What?
Yeah, it was rad, dude. And we saw them. It was opening, I believe it was the opening game of the Cubs season, anyway, of the park. And
Okay.
we got to watch them beat the now World Series champions, the Texas Rangers. So that was my
Oh.
first ever baseball game, was the Cubs beat the Rangers, like I think it was 2-1.
So
But
how cool was Take Me Out to the Ball Game then?
dude, it was so awesome. Like, now granted, I never experienced baseball with the old rules, but the new rules are great. Like, game's done in 2 hours,
Oh yeah.
you know? Yeah. And not having to watch, like he was telling me, he's like, dude, he showed me clips of Nomar, because he's also a Red Sox guy as well, of like that guy, you know, after every swing stepping out of the box and like, you know, basically, and you're like, oh, cool. I don't have to watch athletes think. I can just watch them play now. This is great. Yeah, man. Seventh inning stretch, all that. Take me. It was all, there's a clip of it on my, if you go on my Instagram, it's, you know, from August or April. There's a clip of me like taking a shot where David's behind me just, I mean, he's a huge baseball fan. So just it was awesome, man. I'll go to more games because it was a great experience.
I remember talking with him a little bit about his love for the Braves and them getting
Loves the Braves.
the most recent championship. Happy for
Yeah.
that, I guess. I'm a Rangers fan, so I finally got to experience that for the very first time within the last month.
Oh,
It's as
yeah,
good as
man.
advertised. Speaking of rivalries and rivalries that have more of that that bad Cowboys Eagles blood than the Saints and Falcons, which you dislike one another, but there's a respect there.
Right,
Astros
right.
and Rangers fans despise one another. Astros fans are still trying to trash talk the Rangers,
Yeah.
even after they won the World Series. And it's just like, all right, go back to beating on some trash cans now, guys.
Yeah, go back to cheating, right? Didn't they
Exactly.
full on like, that's also funny because Falcons fans will always bring up Bounty Gate with the Saints, but you're like, well, that's a different type of cheating. You were just asking them to do their job more. But like, they weren't stealing plays or whatever, stealing signals or. Wait, actually, this is how little I pay attention to college football. You're a sports guy.
Yeah.
Did John Harb did Jim Harbaugh, is he about to get axed?
The thought is that he's going to move back to the NFL ranks after this season. Now he is currently sitting out the last of a three-game suspension, which is a game against Ohio State this weekend. I mean, it's a top three matchup, but
Okay.
he's not going to be on the sidelines for that game. And Michigan has had a pretty pedestrian schedule this year, so this is the week that it may catch up with them not having Harbaugh around, excuse me, but it's a little bit like the Astros scandal where everybody is trying to do a version of that. It's just the
Right.
lengths that the Astros went back in 2017 and the lengths that Michigan has gone through over the last handful of seasons now that goes above and beyond just attempting to decipher the opposing team's signals. I mean, they have broken a lot of rules in the process, and it's why Michigan, while they initially postured like they were going to fight the charges, eventually they just accepted the three-game suspension and hope that the NCAA and college football moves on from here. I don't know if it's going to be that simple for them, though. Like, I think that they've brought some pains upon themselves. It's going to require Jim Harbaugh to leave college football to go back to the NFL because he's a weird dude to begin with. And so
Yeah.
when you're throwing that level of pressure on him, I think he realizes that he's better off coaching professionals than the quasi amateurs who are now essentially professionals as well at the college level.
Where does he go? What team? If you're just off the top of your head, where do you think Jim Harbaugh would land?
I've heard a couple of teams. The one that makes most sense to me right now, though, is Chicago.
Oh yeah, okay. Yeah, right there. Yeah.
Yeah.
That would be, I'd like to see another Brother Bowl. That was the most recent Super Bowl played in the dome, I believe, was, yeah, that,
Oh
the
yeah,
Brothers Bowl.
that's
Yeah,
right.
yeah,
Where the
yeah,
lights
yeah.
went out.
Where the lights went out, because, and Beyonce was, yeah, man, that was, what a game. That's my favorite, okay, so my favorite NFL player, arguably ever, is Ed Reed, right?
Oh
I
yeah.
just love, I
He's a
just
stud.
love every, yeah, and I also, the pick six, I think, is one of the coolest moments in sports because it just completely changes the game, right? No matter what's happening in the game, no matter who's winning, no matter what the momentum is, a pick six throws the entire thing into chaos for a moment. And he was the king of the pick six. But I also love just how, you know, he's also from Louisiana. He's a Destrahan boy. So he's like a, you know, he's a Louisiana boy as well. And I just love, like, you know, the gray beard when he got his induction speech into the Hall of Fame, where I think I'm paraphrasing, but he goes, for all the interceptions, I'd like to thank the Cleveland Browns. And he's, you know, he's saying this in Cleveland. So he's getting like this slight boo. And he goes, hold on, hold on. And the Cincinnati Bengals. It's just such a like double moment of like, it ain't, what he say? He goes, it ain't my fault y'all kept changing quarterbacks. And I just love, but I love anyone like, you know, how smart of a player he was and how he like was constantly tricking Peyton Manning into throwing interceptions. And like, I love any player with a high IQ like that, who also like, you know, was a beast. Was that guy who was, I love a guy was an interception machine. So I love me some Ed Reed. So like he, you know, seeing him win that Super Bowl, and he got a pick off Kaepernick. So to get a pick in a Super Bowl that you're winning in your hometown, that's just an amazing feeling, I imagine.
Yeah, safety is my favorite position on the defensive side of the ball. I love me some Ed Reed.
Oh, for sure.
I don't know if anybody has ever looked cooler going into any sports Hall of Fame in the history of Hall of Fames than Ed Reed looked that day. Sean, we're out of time. Thank you so much for the time.
Oh, brother. Thank you. Yeah, thank you.
Real pleasure. Folks, check him out at Creek in the Cave this Friday or Saturday. Two shows each night. I'm going to be at one of the Saturday shows. I can't wait to check it out. You just heard it, all the level-headedness over the last hour or so. You get more of that in framed just as funny and then some if you go see Sean.
Thank you.
And also check out his website, meseanpatton.com. That's S-E-A-N. Sean, thank you so much for the time, man. Safe travels to and from Austin.
Thank you, my friend. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks to Gentleman Jesus for the intro and outro music. Hear more of his work at gentlemanjesus.com. Thanks to you for hanging out. For more of the show and to connect on social media, visit booksonpod.com. We'll talk to you next time on Books on Pod.